This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you live, as many of my peers are on a cruise ship steaming out of, I don't know, someplace in Mexico. I'm gonna actually be joining the ship on Wednesday, so we will be doing our show live today and tomorrow. And then Laura Flanders is going to fill in for us Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, just as a heads up. We've got a action-packed show today. In our second hour, we're going to have both a representative from the Humane Society of the United States and someone from the Competitive Enterprise Institute talking about this whole beef recall and what it means and this whole issue, really, of deregulation in the United States and how destructive it's been. In our third hour, Al Regnery is going to be with us. He is the publisher of The American Spectator. He has a new book, The Ascendance of American Conservatism. This should be an interesting conversation. You know, where are the conservatives going from here? What are the ascendants? And so anyway, that's and also the fellow who really told it how it was on Fox News is going to be joining us at the end of our third hour today. So it's going to be a fascinating time. Also, in about 10, 15 minutes or so, Larissa Alexandrovna of Raw Story is going to come on and talk about the Don Siegelman story that we saw last night on 60 Minutes. If you didn't see this on 60 Minutes, I recommend you go over to thinkprogress.org. They actually have the video clip up. You can watch the segment there, among other websites, but it's right there. It's really easy to see. And what's so amazing is that this story was actually blacked out by many of the CBS affiliates in Alabama. And you tell me, corporate media is not political. Our phone number, 866-303-2270. Our website, tomhartman.com. For our live chat room and our blog and our message board, as well as airamerica.com, the Tom Hartman page over there. Off at the top of Drudge right now, and all over the right-wing websites, is a photograph of Barack Obama wearing basically a turban. I mean, he's dressed. It's from a trip that he took in 2006 when he was visiting Wajir, an area in northeastern Kenya, dressed as if he was a Somali elder. And the headline from the right-wing Drudge site is Clinton staffers circulate, quote, dressed, end quote, Obama. The dressed Obama. And this picture of him and, oh, my God, he looks like a Muslim. I mean, this is the response that they're trying to get. Now, whether this came out of the Clinton camp or not, I frankly don't know. I know that there are, I have two takes on this, two things that I wanted to share with you about, two thoughts on this that I just want to get out there. The first is, I know that there is a small, noisy, and frankly, I think, eccentric minority who are saying, come on, Hillary, the race is over, get out of the race. When, in fact, I think she's only about 100 or so delegates behind a couple of very, very large states that historically have decided elections, Texas and Ohio. The reason Jack Kennedy took Lyndon Johnson, who he hated, as his running mate was because he needed Texas. And look at what decided the 2004 election. It was the theft of the vote in Ohio by Mr. Blackwell, by the Secretary of State Ken Blackwell in Ohio. So these are major and important states. And frankly, I don't think that the Democratic Party should take anything for granted before these two states have come in, at the very least. And Bill Clinton basically has already said, okay, you know, once these states have voted, if Hillary doesn't carry them, then this is the end of it. But in the week between now and then, the week and a day between now and that vote, the Clinton campaign is apparently throwing everything they have at Barack Obama. And I know that there are a bunch of Democrats out there wringing their hands, assuming that this is true, assuming that what is being reported on the right-wing news sites, and that's very often a stretch, but sometimes true, and the thing that seems to give it a little more credibility is that it isn't being denied by the Clinton camp, so who is very good at, you know, instant rebuttals. So assuming that it's true, that the Clinton camp is throwing everything that they have at Barack Obama right now, I want to be on record as saying I think this is a good and healthy thing. Because if we are so concerned about the fragility of the guy who probably is going to be the Democratic nominee, or for that matter, the fragility of Hillary Clinton, with any rebuttals or attacks on her, if we're so concerned about the fragility of either one of these people, then we have forgotten who the Republicans are. We have forgotten about Lee Atwater, the whole campaign. I mean, here's the whole campaign against Michael Dukakis, you know, the Take No Prisoners, you know, the George Herbert Walker Bush, I think it was that, the 88 campaign, as I recall, where they had the photograph of him in the tank with the, you know, with the earmuffs sticking out, basically, you know, the headphones. And that tank photo became an iconic photo, and some think that it brought down Michael Dukakis. It's not what brought down Michael Dukakis. What brought down Michael Dukakis was two things. One, George Herbert Walker Bush ran a campaign that was filled with lies, distortions, and personal smears. It was the politics of personal destruction. The essence of the entire campaign against Michael Dukakis in 88 was the exact same thing that you'll find in today's New York Times, Bill Kristol's op-ed, in which he's saying Barack Obama isn't patriotic enough. He won't wear a flag on his lapel, you know, blah de blah de blah. It's like the guy on Real Time with Bill Maher over the weekend. They had this whack job Republican on who said, oh, you know, Barack Obama, he won't even say the Pledge of Allegiance. It's a lie. Bill Maher apparently didn't know to say, hey, wait a minute, that's a lie. Barack Obama leads the Pledge of Allegiance in the United States Senate, has done so on a number of occasions. There's this photo running around of him and Hillary, and I think it's John Edwards and Bill Richardson, and Hillary and Edwards and Richardson have their hands over their heart and Barack Obama doesn't. That was not the Pledge of Allegiance. That was the national anthem. Sit in a stadium sometime when the national anthem is played, most people don't put their hand over their heart. It's not a pledge. You don't put your hand over your heart unless you're taking a pledge. So, you know, most people don't put their hand over their heart when they sing the national anthem, and that's what that photo is of. I guarantee you that photo and this photo of Barack Obama in a turban or whatever it is, and this African certainly gear, it will be portrayed to the average Yahoo in America as Muslim gear, is going to become the centerpiece of the Republican campaign. But what, and just like Michael Dukakis being, you know, when they asked him, you know, what would you do if your wife was raped and murdered, you know, and he was like, well, I, you know, and he got into this discussion of legal process. I mean, come on. Michael Dukakis allowed them to assassinate him. Barack Obama is not allowing the Clinton campaign to assassinate him. And what is happening here is that these kinds of attacks on him will make him stronger. It's the same thing I was saying last week about John McCain. When the New York Times came out and said, hey, looks like John McCain had an affair with this woman who was a lobbyist, and by the way, he was doing favors for her and she was a lobbyist. I said on this program, in my mind, the big issue is, by the way, he's doing favors for her and she's a lobbyist. I don't care if he's sleeping with her or not. He shouldn't be doing favors for a lobbyist just simply because she's giving him money and free use of a corporate jet to fly all over for his campaigns. And the fact of the matter is that the most lobbyist-connected politician among all of the Republican and all the Democratic candidates is John McCain. He had Charlie Black on as his surrogate on either Meet the Press or Face the Nation this weekend. You know, running his campaign, the guy's the head of a lobbying firm. I mean, this is how crazy it is. So anyhow, this was a gift to John McCain because now as he gets closer to the election, in September, October, November, if the Democrats try to bring up John McCain's association with lobbyists, he's going to be able to say, oh, come on, the New York Times tried that back. That's old news. They tried that 6 months ago. Their public editor even apologized for it. I'm not even going to dignify that with a response. Similarly, if the Clinton campaign can throw out all the opposition research that they can find against Barack Obama right now, and she is still unsuccessful in Ohio and Texas, then that stuff will be out there and it will be behind him. He'll have a chance to respond to it. He will be made stronger by it. This is why we have a primary process. This is why it would be a bad thing for the Democratic Party, for Hillary Clinton right now to pack it in. She should fight all the way up through Texas and Ohio and then make an appropriate and strategic decision based on the number of delegates she has and on the math. But as long as she and Barack Obama are... Now, I wouldn't want to see it go all the way up to the convention. I think that, frankly, would be destructive. And I don't want to see a brokered convention. But another week? Yeah, of course. There's some big states yet to weigh in. And this is the crucible in which Barack Obama's candidacy, and for that matter, Hillary Clinton's candidacy, will be purified and hardened. It's a good thing. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Yes, dreaming of democracy here, 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Live for at least 2 days, then I'm off on the Air America cruise. Then I'll be back for a couple of days, and then I'm off to Darfur in the Sudan. There's information about that on our website, by the way, at tomhartman.com. We're going to be delivering food and a whole bunch of other stuff. All the information is there. And if you'd like to contribute, we're paying for the trip, but any contributions are going to go directly to the people there. If you're interested in that, you can check it out at tomhartman.com. So, last night, CBS News.
Is Don Siegelman in prison because he's a criminal or because he belonged to the wrong political party in Alabama?
Scott Pelley asking that question. Larissa Alexandrovna, the managing editor of news at rawstory.com, is with us. Hey, Larissa.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am just great. You have been way out in front of this story. You've been a guest on this program a number of times with the brilliant investigative reporting you've been doing. And others have been on it as well, but I think you've been one of the real leaders in this. And the thing that struck me about the 60 Minutes piece last night was that there was absolutely no discussion of the election fraud, which led to Siegelman losing his campaign in the first place, which then led to everything else. And I think that that's the big story that they're trying to bury by throwing this guy's butt in jail. What's your take on that?
Well, I mean, I agree with you, but I also understand that there were time constraints. They only had 15 minutes, but my understanding is that the producers and the senior management over at CBS is interested in doing additional episodes of this where they explore various parts of the story as long as the public expresses an interest.
Wow.
Yes.
So
I mean, there's so many elements to this story, but I think the bombshell last night about Nick Bailey, the witness against Don Siegelman, and the check that he claims to have seen being handed to Don Siegelman, when in fact the check was cut days after the alleged...
Right, and that was the sole basis on which Don Siegelman is in jail.
Right.
Is that this guy who was a career criminal or was a criminal and who was under indictment and who cut a deal to get out of jail in exchange for testifying against Don Siegelman, apparently lied on the stand and in order to get his favorable treatment, and that lie was the basis of the conviction, and now we find that it clearly was a lie.
Well, and moreover, what they didn't report and what I have been looking at is there are allegations that Nick Bailey's brother, who was alleged to be just as corrupt as his brother, was being threatened with jail time if Nick Bailey did not cooperate with the prosecution.
Okay, so for our listeners who may just be tuning in,
yeah,
let's just recap this thing really quickly. I'll run through it real fast, and you correct me if I've got anything wrong, okay?
Okay.
Number one, Don Siegelman, Democrat. In a red state, he's the governor of the state. He runs for re-election. He goes to sleep one night. He's won. He wakes up the next morning. A Republican operative in a Republican county in the middle of the night has discovered an extra 15,000 or something like that votes and says, "Oh, gee, look at this. The Republican Bob Riley won." Siegelman protests. A whole series of prosecutions begin against Siegelman. Karl Rove has is orchestrating this from Washington, D.C., making calls down to Alabama to get rid of this guy, hires a woman to follow him around, see if she can get photographs of him. There's a whole series of prosecutions. This is a classic example of why we should be looking at the prosecutors who kept their jobs, not the seven who are nine who were fired. And finally, they nail him for taking a $250,000 check for his education lottery fund. Not for himself. Not a penny ever went in his own pocket. It wasn't
That's
even
correct.
Suggested. For this guy giving money to this state fund, and according to the allegation, in exchange for that, he put this guy on the hospital board, which the guy had already been on for three terms.
Correct.
This is like giving George Bush a campaign contribution and ending up the ambassador to Paris. I mean, that's the
entirely
the analogy.
Correct. Yes.
Right. And so Don Siegelman now. And then we find out that the check was, in fact, cut several days later. It didn't come out of that meeting. It couldn't have happened the way it said. And so Don Siegelman is
the prosecution knew this.
And didn't tell the defense, which they have
Correct.
a legal requirement to tell the defense of exculpatory information.
Right.
And then on top of that, rather than giving Don Siegelman, the traditional 45 days to get his affairs in order, white collar crime, they lead him out in shackles, and he's been locked down and shut up ever since.
Right, and they moved him around from state to state so that his lawyers had no access to him.
Yeah, so
and the media still has no access to him. If you saw last night's 60 Minutes, you saw him from far away, but the media is not allowed any contact with him.
All right, so we have about a half a minute, Larissa. You said if CBS gets feedback, they'll continue on this story. How do we give that feedback to CBS?
You can contact 60 Minutes, and actually, if you go to CBS.com and you go to 60 Minutes, the contact information is right there.
Really? So you can just send them an email or give them a call?
Give them a call, send them an email, post in the comments. But certainly go ahead and please do something. Because parts of the other thing that I want to briefly touch on is that in parts of Alabama yesterday, this story did not air.
Yeah, I mentioned that at the beginning of the hour, that it was blacked out in a number of TV stations. And
Correct.
This is absolutely bizarre. The Alabama TV station said it was the feed from New York. CBS has come out and officially said, no, it was not the feed from New York. And so apparently the Karl Rove machine is still alive and well in Alabama.
Apparently.
Larissa Alexandrovna, one of our finest investigative reporters in the United States, rawstory.com. Thank you, Larissa.
Thank you.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Why don't we liberate these United States? We're the ones who need it worse.
You tell them, Merle.
Let the rest of the world help us for change. And let's rebuild America first. Our highways and bridges are falling apart. Who's blessed? Who has been cursed? There's things to be done all over the world, but let's rebuild America first.
Now, I've said, when you've lost Merle Haggard, you've lost the rest of America. I know Merle Haggard's been a Democrat most of his life, but he, to the best of my knowledge, he's never been as outspoken as this. I mean, here's a song that just... He says, let's get out of Iraq, take this country back. I mean, it's just incredible. And, yeah, I think that Joe Sixpack, the country western listeners out there are going to be listening to this song by Merle Haggard going, yeah, and you're going to lose them, John McCain. Anyhow, welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, also brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. It's Monday, February 25th. It is 9:35 in the morning on the West Coast, noon 35 in the afternoon on the East Coast, and all places in between. We're doing the show live today and tomorrow, Wednesday through Friday. Laura Flanders will be filling in for me as I go off on the Air America cruise. Then we'll be back. The other big news story that I wanted to mention, give you just a very short riff on, and then we'll be picking up your phone calls right after that, is Ralph Nader jumped into the race over the weekend. He did so on one of the weekend shows, Meet the Press or Face the Nation. I can never keep them straight. And made the argument that, you know, hey, the real issues aren't being discussed, quack, quack, quack. The standard Ralph Nader shtick. Although he didn't go so far as to say, you know, the Republicrats or the Demo, whatever, you know, the old line that he used back in 2000. I am not at all worried about this. Just like I'm not at all worried, if Barack Obama attacks Hillary Clinton, I'm not concerned that that's going to hurt her ability to be a good, strong nominee for President of the United States. And if Hillary Clinton attacks Barack Obama, I'm not concerned that that's going to harm his ability to be a good, strong nominee for President of the United States. Either one of them are fine with me. Either one of them will make great candidates. Either one of them would make a great president of the United States. And the primary battle is going to strengthen them both. One of them is going to come out stronger. One of them is going to come out the victor. But it's going to strengthen them both. I'm just not worried about it. I have enough faith in the Democratic Party, in Democrats, in progressives, in Americans to know that when the Republican machine comes after the Democrats, it's going to come huge. So now what about Ralph Nader? So here you got Ralph Nader out there. I think it's frankly important that Ralph Nader be speaking out. I would frankly rather he wasn't speaking out as a candidate, because he probably will peel off a few votes. Some of the Kucinich diehards, for example, the folks who are, you know, just absolutely purists. Carl Jung, the famous psychologist, had this notion of judgers versus perceivers. Judgers are people who can see all sides of an issue and they see the gray all in between. And perceivers are people who see the world in black or right, white. It's right or it's wrong. It's my way or the highway, that kind of thing. And they're absolutely unwilling to compromise. And there's a small percentage of American people, typically of people in general, maybe some, perhaps as small as 5%, perhaps as large as 20%, who are judgers, who are just these hard judgers. And some of the judges who have been in the Kucinich camp will now be in the Nader camp. But frankly, it's going to be irrelevant. You know, in the 2004 election, Nader, the vote that he got was irrelevant. And as Nader said, if the Democrats can't take this thing by a landslide, they don't, you know, they've really blown it big time. So, and I would like there to be some press coverage of a guy, even if he's viewed as an eccentric crank, which is how he will be portrayed in the media, count on it. I think it's important that there be somebody out there speaking about the issues that Ralph Nader actually speaks about, that single-payer health care is actually the program we should have, rather than this whizzing war between Hillary and Obama about the nuance of a program that keeps intact all the health insurance companies, et cetera. I mean, you know, there's a lot of areas where I think Ralph Nader is actually speaking truth, and it's important that he be there, in my opinion. So... Mo in Los Angeles. Hey, Mo, you think I don't like Hillary?
Oh, well, I know you just gave a very balanced comment about it, but 15 minutes ago you said in a very angry voice, and I think Hillary Clinton should pull out of the race right now. And I just...
No, wait a minute, Mo. I did not say that. I said there are some people, a small, eccentric, lunatic fringe within this party, who are saying that they think that Hillary should pull out right now. I believe that she should stay in the race at least until Ohio and Texas, and at that point, she and her campaign need to make the strategic and appropriate decision about whether to stay in. I would not like to see this thing go all the way to the convention. I don't think it's going to. She's said it won't. Her husband has said it won't. There's a consensus in the Clinton camp it won't. I think that she should stay in the race because I think it's good for her. I think it's good for Obama, and I think it's good for the Democratic Party for their to be this fight going on, because it strengthens both of them as candidates, whoever ends up the nominee. That's
well,
what I said.
Well, you can retract and act like you didn't say that, but you did, and I heard first time.
Mo, I recommend that you go to airamerica.com. You can hear the actual tape of what I said.
While you hated the same people I hate, but now that you hate someone I love, I don't want to listen to radio that runs on hate. I don't think you're any better than the other side that runs on hate.
Okay. Well, Mo, thank you very much. I'm very sorry that you misheard what I said. I strongly recommend you go back and listen to the audio. I was very explicit saying, you know, there are some crackpots out there who are calling for Hillary to get out of the race now. I think it's a huge mistake. I don't think it's good for the Democratic Party for her to get out now. She needs to take this thing all the way through Texas and Ohio, and she needs to fight with everything she's got. And that's what she's doing. And I salute her for that. That's what I said. And if you, I'm saying go back and listen. Richard in New Jersey, listening to WWRL. Hey, Richard.
Yeah, hi. I'm just calling about the Ralph Nader.
Yeah.
He reminds me of the locusts who were underground for 7 years and then come out.
They pop back up. Is there like Freddy Krueger? That's
it. Well, you know, the point is, though, is that, you know, you heard him at the Green Party. You know, he made a big splash that I'm the only, you know, there's no difference. And he came out and, and ripped everybody and allowed this this shrub in the White House to be president. Then 4 years later, the Greens disowned him, and then he did it the same thing. You didn't hear. So for 7 years of this administration, you haven't heard a word from him.
Well, actually, for the 7 years, Nader has been speaking out a lot. In fact, he's been on this program two or three times speaking out. What has happened is that the mainstream media, the corporate media in the United States, will not cover somebody who is not, who doesn't have some platform to speak from. Just the fact that he's Ralph Nader is not enough to get him coverage. When he's running for president, that's enough to get him coverage. So they're covering him now, but he's been speaking out all along in defense of Ralph Nader. And I agree in the 2000 election, although I am not of the opinion that Ralph Nader caused Al Gore to lose, because I don't think Al Gore lost. I think that George Bush stole the election. And let's just be, you know, upfront and honest about that and call it what it is. That said, had those Nader votes in Florida never happened, then it would have been a little harder for the Republicans to steal it. But frankly, I think they would have stolen it anyway. I think they had very much their finger on the pulse of exactly how many votes were where, and they would have figured out which county to pull another 90,000 votes out of, and they would have done it. I think that they just would have done it. There's no doubt in my mind. But, you know, in 04, Nader was not a factor. And in this election, he will not be a factor. It's just not going to happen. But he is saying things that, in my opinion, need to be said. Cedric in Wyoming. Thanks, Cedric, for calling. What's up?
Hey, how you doing there, Tom?
Good. Great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Yeah, I wanted to say that I think the Ralph Nader thing is a good idea, especially for people like me. I think the number one problem we have in this country is outsourcing illegal aliens. And Ralph Nader's the only guy that's in the campaign right now that I can see is willing to talk about the issues of the day. That is outsourcing and protecting our jobs. Because John McCain is not going to do it. He wants to give illegal aliens amnesty. And you take a look at Barack Obama, he's not even talking about the problem. He's not talking about outsourcing our illegal aliens.
Well, actually,
and I think that Ralph Nader is the only one who's willing to talk about protecting our jobs. Nobody else is doing it, not even Hillary.
Okay, got your point, Cedric. And I agree that he would be a good thing in the campaign, although let's just be upfront about this and straight about this. Both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are now outspokenly opposed to things like NAFTA. In fact, Hillary is now saying that she took issue with her husband back when he was a proponent of NAFTA. Barack Obama is attacking her in her autobiography, saying that one of Bill Clinton's big accomplishments was NAFTA. It's interesting to see how that little war is going on. I call it a whizzing match. But bottom line is, I think that both of them are starting to taking reasonably progressive issues, both on immigration and on outsourcing of jobs. Dan in Sacramento, California. Hey, Dan.
How's it going?
Just great. What's up?
I'm glad that you brought up the Nader thing, because that's what I wanted to talk about. I agree with you that I think that it's a good thing that both Hillary and Barack Obama are, you know, taking some flack right now in the primaries, because that's going to make them stronger. But the fact that Ralph Nader is, like, bypassing that whole thing, you know, and just going into the general election, I think that I am worried.
What it's going to mean is he's going to get nothing, because he's not going to have the Green Party behind him this time.
Well, see, the thing about that is, it's like, I feel like since the media is kind of corporate owned, that they might even give him a little bit of, like, airtime, just enough to where he can scoop enough votes off the Democrats to make it easier for the Republicans to steal.
He is not going to take any more votes from the Democrats than the Libertarian Party is going to take from the Republicans. In fact, the Libertarian Party, given Ron Paul's high stature and visibility in this primary season, Libertarian Party is probably going to take a hell of a lot more votes.
But Ron Paul's not running as an independent in the
No, but he's not. But all the Libertarians get it, that Ron Paul is a Libertarian. And so the Libertarian Party will field a candidate and will be on the ballot in many states and will pull votes away from the Republicans. I just don't think that I really don't believe that Ralph Nader is going to pull votes away from the Democratic candidates. He didn't, for all practical purposes, in 2004. He won't again. And it's important to have somebody speaking the truth out there. 45 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Best before they are.
Let's just get everybody together. Let's get unified. The sky will open.
A little sarcasm here.
The light will come down. Celestial choirs will be singing. And everyone will know we should do the right thing and the world will be perfect. Maybe I've just lived a little long, but I have no illusions about how hard this is going to be. You are not going to wave a magic wand and have the special interest disappear.
And, you know, she's absolutely right. She's absolutely right. And that's the issue that Obama, the two biggest challenges that Barack Obama has right now are, number one, that he is not perceived in the media. I mean, you go to his website, all the details are there. He does talk about the issues in these campaigns and things like that, but he's not perceived by the average person as having the specifics, even though he does, and as does Hillary Clinton. And number two, this picture that apparently was released by the Clinton camp this morning, although, as I said, if they hadn't released it, you know, thank God, actually, that they did now, if they did, whoever did, according to, it's at the top of Drudge right now, drudgereport.com, Clinton staffers circulate dressed Obama. This picture of Barack Obama in a turban or whatever and when he was visiting Africa. And you're going to hear more of this. This is from the Michael Savage Show last Thursday or Friday.
What about the Muslim connection to Obama? Barack Hussein Obama, father Muslim, grandfather Muslim. Nothing wrong with that. But we, the American people, being at war with radical Islam, have a need to know just exactly what kind of Muslim he was exposed to, what kind of Muslim he is, what kind of Muslim teachings he's friendly to. We have a right to know if he's a so-called friendly Muslim or one who aspires to more radical teachings. That's something that the media ought to be concerned about, not whether John McCain had an infatuation with a lobbyist 10 years ago. But then I'm expecting too much. Much too much. You understand that? When a major reporter who is reasonably educated knows nothing about Obama's Muslim background.
Maybe because there isn't any. Maybe because his father converted to Catholicism when he came to the United States. Maybe because Barack Obama was never raised as a Muslim. Maybe, you know, could be. Charlie in Los Angeles. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Tom. First of all, the woman who said that you said Hillary should get out now
right.
was wrong. What you said, there are people out there who say
that's correct.
That she should get out there. She should get out now. But then, in your defense of what you actually said, you called people who say that
the fringe
and extremists. Yes. I think a lot of people who say that, and I'm not one of them. I think there's at least three more big, important primaries, and with two coming up right away. I think those people are making a tactical decision that they think it would be good to stop the infighting now.
But see, it's not infighting.
Well,
it is not infighting. It's campaigning.
Well,
there's a difference.
If you want to call it campaigning,
I mean, you ain't seen nothing yet. Wait until the Republicans get a hold of this. This is not hurting the Democratic Party. This is making the Democratic Party stronger. If I was a Republican operative, and I wanted to make sure that I could take down Barack Obama in October or November, I would do everything I could right now to get Hillary Clinton out of the race so that her people and her opposition research would not bring up things like, for example, this picture of Barack Obama with the turban on, so that I could sit on that until 3 weeks before the election and drop it like a bombshell just before the general election. That's what I would be doing.
I understand that, but I don't think that being disparaging about people who have a different tactical point of view and calling them the fringe and whatever else. You use another.
They're on the fringe. People who are saying that are on the fringe of the political process. The mainstream of the Democratic Party and of the Democratic political process believes that people should compete in a primary until it's obvious that they can't win, at which point they should gracefully bow out. It's not clear right now that Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton are clearly going to win. If Hillary Clinton wins both Texas and Ohio, there's a very good chance she could go on and end up winning this nomination. If Barack Obama wins both of them, in all probability, he'll win it. Let's let the voters decide. Let's not have some talk show host or some bloviator on a talking head on a TV network show decide who is going to be the Democratic nominee. And let's let the process, as rough and tumble as it gets, let's let it play out now, because that's going to steel and harden those candidates in a way that will be beneficial to the Democratic Party come November.
I agree with everything you say, but I disagree with you disparaging people who have a different tactical point of view.
Well, Charlie, we're going to have to agree to disagree. Thank you very much. I mean, I'm not calling them stupid or evil or even or mean-spirited or, you know, having bad motives. I'm not attributing any of that to those folks who are doing that. This is not a personal attack, but I believe that I am accurate in saying that those folks are on the fringe of the Democratic Party and the political process, or don't understand politics. Marcy in Santa Fe. Hey, Marcy, you got about a minute here before we got to wrap up this hour. What's up?
Hi, I just want to address the man who called in, who's pro Nader, and you know, he's one of those one or two issue people. He was so stuck on outsourcing and undocumented immigration,
right?
And you know, he's willing to vote based on that. And That's
Carl Jung's judgers, you know, that's 10% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Which is,
yeah.
You know,
yeah. And, you know, and they are the ones who have put us in the situation this country is in now, the, you know, abortion or, you know, gay rights or rather anti-gay people. You know, they can't do that. They have to look at the whole picture. We have to look at the whole picture and try to get our country back on track.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you, Marcy. And agreed. And we have to. And frankly, I think both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton can handle this. The Democratic Party has to be ready for the Republicans to throw at them what the George Herbert Walker Bush campaign threw at Michael Dukakis, basically saying, oh, he's not patriotic enough, he won't wear a flag on his lapel, he didn't put his hand over his heart when they were singing the national anthem, which most people don't do. That's the Pledge of Allegiance. Get it right, guys. You know, I mean, the Democrats have to say, this is about the bigger issues. And that's what both these candidates have been doing. God bless them.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Call 866-303-2270. The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations.
Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Lena Johansson with the Science and Biotechnology Journalist and Fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, is on the line with us. Lena, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. How are you doing today?
Just great. And also, Paul Shapiro is with us. He's with the Humane Society of the United States. He's their Director for Factory Farming, HSUS.org, the website. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. I'm glad to be on.
Wanted to get the two of you on talking about this. The Humane Society put out a video which has led to this, among others, which has led to this massive beef recall, 143 million pounds of beef. It's enough to stack hamburgers from Los Angeles to New York. And the Competitive Enterprise Institute then came out with a press release blasting or questioning the motives of the Humane Society. So, Lena, let me toss it to you first, since you were making the charges against the Humane Society. What's your take on this?
Well, first of all, there were no health concerns about this recall. So it's a big scare tactic, I think, for U.S. consumers. Nobody's gotten sick from this. And I was also a little bit shocked that the Humane Society sat on this for 6 weeks while they were finishing up their documentary. Because if they were concerned about the health of these animals, and if they were concerned about the health of the humans that were getting this meat, I would call USDA and get that plant shut down right away. But that's me, you know?
Okay. Before we go to Paul, just two quick questions. One, my understanding is that the big issue with downer animals, cows that are so sick or incapable of walking across that magic white line there before they walk into the slaughterhouse, is that they may have bovine spongiform encephalopathy, BSE, also known as mad cow disease, and that can take a year, 5 years, a decade, 20 years to show up in a human. So we have no idea how many people might have gotten sick if a BSE-infected cow was one of those downer cows.
But the footage that, and Paul, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but as far as I could, you know, get from the USDA paper, was that all of these cattle had gone through the health inspection already. So all of those downer cows should already be taken out of the food supply. And the cows that we see on that video are the cows that went down while in the holding pen and could not get back up.
Okay, so Paul, you know, why did it take 6 weeks for the Humane Society to put this video out and put a stop to this? And what's the story with the donor cows?
Sure. Well, first, let me just explain for those who aren't familiar. Essentially, what happened is that the Humane Society of the United States had one of our investigators employed in a Southern California dairy cow slaughter plant. And he was employed there for about 6 weeks documenting the conditions that these animals were subjected to. And the conditions were horrific. Crippled cows were being tortured on a daily basis. Workers on the video can be seen kicking cows, ramming them with the blades of a forklift, jabbing them in the eyes, electrocuting them, even waterboarding them, all in an attempt to get these crippled cows to march to their own death inside of the slaughter plant. Yeah, at least one case, there was a worker who used a high-pressured hose forcing it up the nostrils and down the mouth of a cow yelling, "Get up or die, get up or die." And you can watch this on the video. Now, second of all, the assertion made that there are no health concerns and that no donors went into the food supply is not only wrong, it's also contradictory of what USDA itself says. I mean, we need to just look at the facts. The USDA even has an op-ed in today's issue of the Tennessean in which it explicitly says that it now acknowledges that donors at this plant went into the human food supply chain. We shouldn't come on to radio shows and make allegations that have no basis in factual reality. And finally, on the issue of the sitting on the information, little could be further from the truth. After our investigator was done with his investigation, we categorized all of the footage, dozens of hours of investigative footage, and we gave it over almost immediately to the authorities in San Bernardino County, California, and asked them to charge the culpable parties with criminal animal cruelty. They specifically asked us. The prosecutor said, "Please do not go public with this while we are conducting our investigation." Mm. And that's when time began elapsing, and eventually we said, "This is getting out of control. We shouldn't be waiting this long. We need to turn this over to the public." And that's when we gave it to people like Dr. Temple Grandin, who is an expert in cattle handling, and to the USDA before we released it to the public, and then to the public. So, I mean, for those who want to try to criticize the people who exposed this cruelty that was going on, all I would say is that the USDA should not be relying on private animal welfare charities such as the Humane Society of the United States to be doing their job for them. And that includes not only preventing the egregious cruelty that was forced upon these crippled cows, but also preventing them from going into the human food supply chain, which the USDA admits happened.
Paul and Lena, this leads us to a larger issue. And, you know, Lena, if you want to rebut or respond to any of that, you're welcome to. And maybe you can incorporate it into your response to this, because I think that the larger issue here is that the beef industry spent $41 million in the last 10 years lobbying for deregulation. $41 million. And 80% of that money went to Republican politicians, by the way. And the Bush administration, as a consequence of some of that $41 million that was spent over the last 10 years, in 2002, killed a proposal that was in the U.S. Senate that would have prevented meatpackers from using donor cattle. It actually killed this thing. I mean, this was 5 months before we actually discovered BSE, mad cow disease, in Washington State. Then in May of 2003, Congress again blocked a ban like this, again largely as a consequence of this funding. In fact, a San Jose Mercury News story found that those members of the House of Representatives from California who voted against the ban received five times as much money in campaign contributions from the beef and dairy industry as those who voted for the ban. The National Cattlemen's Association, Mary Waters, is now the Deputy Secretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs at USDA. Dr. Chuck Lambert, who was a hog farm, owned a giant hog farm called Infinity LLC, is now the Deputy Secretary of State. Excuse me, as Jim Mosley is the Deputy Secretary of State, or Agriculture, excuse me. Chuck Lambert is the Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs. He was the Chief Economist for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Mary Waters, the Assistant Secretary for Congressional Relations at USDA, was the Senior Director and Legislative Counsel for ConAgra Food. It seems to me like USDA has become a wholly owned subsidiary of the beef industry, the Republican Party, another arm of them, and, you know, which I'm guessing you would defend as free speech by corporations, Lena?
Well, I mean, I'm not here to defend neither the Republican Party nor the government, since I'm a fan of neither of them. But there are two things that I want to get to. First of all, we have not let down our cattle into our food supply since the ban in 1997 when we discovered the mad cow disease. So the fact that down our cows got in here was after they had passed the health inspection, and these were cows that went down while in the holding pen. They should not have gotten in there, and that is correct, which is why the beef was recalled in the first place. But there are still, this is a class 2 recall, so let's not even go into that part. But, you know, I would rather have people like the Humane Society of the U.S. do the health inspections and the humanity inspections, because they're so much better at it than the government.
Wait a minute. The Humane Society, we have no standards for the Humane Society. I don't get to vote for a legislator who's going to hold the Humane Society accountable. The only way that I can force the Humane Society to do anything is to offer or withhold a contribution, which isn't going to force them to do anything.
No,
we're talking about the difference between a government regulatory agency that's accountable to we the people versus a voluntary charity, and you want the voluntary charity to be regulating the quality of food
that our children are eating? And Tom, let me just say here also, I mean, first of all, obviously it's not the Humane Society of the U.S. of the United States' job to be inspecting these plants. At the same time, the assertion that we haven't let down our cows into the food supply, again, not only goes against the current statement from USDA on this case, but the USDA's own Office of the Inspector General issued a report a couple years ago that found that, in fact, downers were still getting into the food supply. And, in fact, not only did the Office of the Inspector General for USDA find that, but it also found that at one slaughter plant in Iowa, while cows were being abused, USDA's inspectors were sleeping. They were playing computer games, and they were eating meat.
Well, see, this plays into Lena's argument that you guys should be doing the inspection instead of the government.
Well, you know, I appreciate the compliment from her on that, but I think that Americans generally expect their government to work for them. And in this case, it's clear, even according to the USDA's own self-investigative arm.
So, Lena, we just have a few seconds left.
The government did not work here, and that's sort of the point I'm trying to make. The government should not be involved in oversight of the food supply.
But isn't it that it didn't work?
They suck at it.
Yeah, but isn't it that they suck at it because they're underfunded and because you have an administration that doesn't believe in it?
No, I think they suck at it because it's not a natural thing for the government to do. The beef processors
should be doing
actually
it
should be paying for the service, and whether they pay the Humane Society or another private organization.
Lena, we're out of time. We're out of time. People can read about it at CEI.org and HSUS.org. Thank you both.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Yeah, you're just absolutely free to choose. I mean, this is really the issue here. It's like, what are we doing about the commons? What do you know, this libertarian worldview, by the way, speaking of libertarian worldviews in politics, it's being reported right now that Mitt Romney might re-enter the Republican race. One of his sons just told the Los Angeles Times that he's considering re-entering the race following on the revelations of John McCain's possible affair, if you want to spin it sexually, or possible corruption, if you want to spin it the way I think it really should be spun. John McCain, the most lawyered up is the lawyer phrase. I don't know what the phrase is for lobbyist up, you know, or something like that. Lobbied up. There you go. We're going to have to invent some language here of all of the candidates on both sides. But in any case, back to the question, the real question here is, who's in charge of the commons? Who's looking out for all of us? Who's looking out for our interests? And the libertarian suggestion that is put forward by quote, conservative think tanks or libertarian think tanks generally is, and candidates like Ron Paul, generally is, and some are, and many Republicans, is, well, you know, people ought to be able to figure these things out themselves. We're in favor of freedom. Freedom of choice. Let people decide if they want to eat beef from a downer cow or not. It might be cheaper. Maybe they want to save some money. The problem is, if we were a nation of little towns and communities. I mean, in some ways, actually, this is where Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton diverged. And Jefferson was far more libertarian on these kind of things than was Hamilton, who thought that there should be government regulation and government support and high tariffs and things. And frankly, and this is one of those areas where Hamilton was right and Jefferson was wrong, in my opinion. And because Jefferson was looking at the United States as a bunch of small local agricultural communities, which by and large we were at the time. Hamilton was looking forward into the future and seeing us as an industrial superpower, which made Jefferson shudder. He thought, you know, he didn't want us to be like London, you know, with all the poverty and the Dickensian stories. But here we are. We're an industrial superpower. We have fulfilled Alexander Hamilton's vision. And now because we don't have small local communities, you don't know where your beef comes from. Assuming that you eat it. I haven't eaten beef in 40 years or longer, but you know, there are people out there who eat the stuff. And I'm telling you, if you eat beef or any other kind of meat, you don't know where it came from. For that matter, if you eat vegetables, I eat vegetables. I don't know where they came from. You know, we have these E. coli outbreaks from stuff that came in from Chile or something. It's what? I'm getting lettuce from Chile? In the country. So anyhow, the question is, how do we protect this stuff? How do we make sure that we're all safe in a world where, or in a nation, certainly in a world by and large, but particularly in a nation where the economic system is set up to give arguably an advantage to predators? If somebody can figure out, at least over the short term, if somebody can figure out how to game the system, they will win over the short term. And this is where the whole libertarian argument breaks down, is the whole issue of harm. Yes, they will say, when somebody does something wrong, when somebody does something that is fraudulent, for example, selling BSE-infected, mad cow-infected beef as healthy beef, if they do that, then after the fact, you can convict them of fraud. But in the meantime, you got a bunch of people who are going to get early onset Alzheimer's or mad cow disease or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, there's no way to prevent that harm. If we collectively want to prevent harm from happening, and we know these are real harms out there, and we know that there are slick operators, there are exploiters among us who will take advantage of those harms and will internalize the profits and externalize onto the rest of society the costs. The cost being the cost of health care and taking care of people and the loss of productivity and everything else, then we, the people, have to say, okay, we're going to take responsibility for this. And if the USDA isn't working, then we, the people, have to say, damn it, we want a U.S. Department of Agriculture that is doing inspections, that does do the work. And if they're not, if they're goofing off, if they're asleep at the switch, just like FEMA was asleep at the switch down in New Orleans, and it is the direct consequence of an administration that is saying, you know, we just don't believe in this government stuff. We just don't think it's a good idea. We just, you know, as Ronald Reagan said,
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Yeah, see, if you subscribe to that worldview and the government that's running this, and so they cut back on inspectors and they can legislation that, or do away with legislation signing statement it to death, whatever legislation that would make the protections even stronger. If that's what you're going to do, then of course you're going to break those agencies, and then you can point at them and say, see, they're broken. Government shouldn't be doing that. We should have voluntary organizations doing that. Or we should have organizations that are being paid for by private industry doing that. And I tell you, history shows that when private industry is paying another part of private industry to be their oversight, well, for example, the bond rating agencies looking at the mortgages, the subprime mortgages that are being bundled as securities and saying, oh, yeah, that's a AAA security. Grease my palm, please. What you see is that when the watchdogs have as their first motive profit rather than the public good, then very, very often, surprise, profit wins and the public good gets screwed. 28 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You see everything. You see every part. You see all my light. And you love my dark.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. I guess our question for the hour...
Where's the beef?
Where's the beef? Hey, where's the beef?
You tell him, Clara. Where's the beef from? Alan, where's the beef in the Clinton campaign? Where's the beef in the Obama campaign? Where's the beef in the John McCain campaign? And is Mitt Romney going to rise up like Freddy Krueger and come back? Actually, I don't know. I've never seen a Freddy Krueger movie, so maybe that's not the best metaphor. But, you know, like in the old, the Mummy Returns, right? Is that what's happened? 866-303-2270, our telephone number. A lot on the table that we've been discussing here throughout the last hour and a half or so. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David, what's on your mind today?
Oh, you mean Willard Romney? Anyway.
Yes, yeah, Willard Romney.
You know, the I think everybody, if they're going to eat choosy meat, should buy organic grass-fed cows that are treated really well up to their death.
And grown locally or raised
yes.
locally.
Yeah. Yes, and there's a lot that's local. People just, you know, dig around the local organic food house. But anyways, you know, the clip of Hillary saying that we need to choose a president who doesn't just rely on words but work, she didn't even bother to vote on the Senate vote 2 weeks ago, giving the telecom companies immunity, yeah. which is now stalled in the House.
David
McCain voted to give immunity, and the telecom or the lobbyist that McCain was involved with was a telecom lobbyist.
Yeah, that's the big deal. I mean, whether or not Hillary was voting or whether or not Obama was voting, I mean, I could find votes of both of theirs that I object to. But, you know, I'm not going to, at this point in time, you know, let's let the campaigns go up against each other rather than us. I mean, you're welcome to weigh in with your preference, and your preference is apparent. But yeah, McCain's corruption is with a telecom lobbyist, and that's certainly something that we should all be talking about. David in Portland, Oregon. Hey, David. Another David?
Hello.
David? Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, hey. Good to talk to you. Really enjoy the show. Listen, just a couple of quick observations, and then I'll get to the meat of it. It's kind of a treat for you today. You're talking to a Republican in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And so that kind of puts my comments in perspective.
I should note, David, that in the five counties that make up the metro area of Portland, three of them went for Bush in the last two elections.
Yeah, I apologize about that.
This is not entirely a blue area. It's a rather purple area.
Yeah, well, it's out there in the suburbs. But anyway, I want to encourage my fellow Republicans to vote for Ike in the May primary here in Oregon. Eisenhower in 08, he's our man. Let's take the party back from the American Taliban.
There you go. Okay. That's
I mean, we got our choice. We got to vote for either a dead man or a dead man walking. So, you know, take your choice.
Well said, David. Thank you very much. The most articulate Republican in the city of Portland, Oregon. Noah in Modesto, California. Hey, Noah, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I had some really important news that I want to share with you and your audiences. As you know, because of the economic meltdown here in the state of California, the state of California has decided to pass a budget slash as a result this weekend. The Modesto School Board of Supervisors decided to cut $12 million in services at our local schools, and the services cut will include cutting of librarians, nurses, after school programs, music classes, many programs for low income children, and it's a big concern for us. I wanted to get your take on how are we going to tackle this issue.
This is the ongoing Republican war against the commons. The commons is an idea that has been well understood since the founding of this country. Ben Franklin organized one of the first public libraries, one of the first public fire departments in Philadelphia. I mean, we have long understood that we are a nation of barn builders and communities and people who look out for each other rather than a nation of selfish libertarians who think that if me, mine, you know, first and only is the primary motivation of everybody, that ultimately somehow that's going to be good for society. But that latter mentality has severely infected, through organizations like the Cato Institute and whatnot, these libertarian think tanks, severely infected the Republican Party. It's very seductive.
And what would you recommend for us as a community? Who do we contact? Would you recommend contacting first to tackle this issue.
Well, Modesto, obviously you need to talk to your local elected officials, you know, your city council or town council or community, whatever it's called in your community, and or mayor. And also, you might want to think about running some good people for office, maybe even yourself. Get involved with the local party. If these are partisan offices, then get involved with the Democratic or Republican parties and say, hey, you know, I want to have a say in this. If they're nonpartisan offices, then get involved with the campaigns. Find good people. Get them out there. Get them working. You know, we really see this process work well here in Portland, by the way, particularly since Eric Sten, God bless him, got through voter-owned elections. And so we have elections that are actually owned by the people. And there's you know, when corporate money comes in, it gets balanced. And it's just a fine thing. Thanks a lot for the call. John in North Hollywood, California. Hey, John, listening on K-Talk. What's up?
Hi. Well, all the issues about the meat quality and beef quality and the treatment of cattle, it reminds me of how everything in this government seems to be mistreating and treating the people of this country like cattle. And I just want us to realize that we do have the responsibility because we're made responsible for all these mistakes. And we do have the power already. We've just ceded control to a bunch of shysters and a bunch of criminals. And we just need to, as you say, Tom, take it back or find it for once, find the control of this country.
Yeah.
For
get
once
out, get out
in
there and,
history.
Yeah, get out there and get involved. The long history of regulation, of oversight, of what the Republicans refer to as big government, what I think we should appropriately refer to as government of, by, and for we the people, that works for we the people, that is here for we the people. We need to go back to it. We need to take it back. You're absolutely right. Mary in Huntsville, Alabama. Hey, Mary.
Yes. I am, first of all, I love your program, mostly because I know whatever I hear from you is based on facts and truth. I know if I repeat it, it's not just going to be hearsay. Thank you for that. But I want to tell your listeners that what's going on here in Alabama, you know, you covered it in depth, and I thank you for that. However,
you're talking about the Don Siegelman story.
Is the Don Siegelman story on CBS 60 Minutes.
Right, last night.
We, unfortunately, nationwide, when anybody hears Alabama, they think Bubba's down here. You know, well, this is also the place where the rocket scientists are for NASA.
You're right.
And the thing with this story is that it's got the fingerprints of Karl Rove and George Bush all over it. Our Republican governor at present, who supposedly won over Don Siegelman, is a really good longtime buddy of George Bush and Karl Rove.
Karl Rove was a consultant to his campaign.
Correct.
Mary, you live in Huntsville, Alabama. Did the CBS show, was it blacked out on your station last night?
Completely blacked out. We
Amazing.
Were just furious.
Just that segment of 60 Minutes?
Yeah.
What did the screen go black, or did they play old Lawrence Welk reruns, or what?
What happened was we turned on the program. It was blacked out almost immediately. There was a little bit of sound for a minute or so. Then that went out, too. The last maybe 2 minutes of the presentation made it on the air. We called the station immediately, said, what in the heck is going on? And they gave us a stupid excuse. I mean, it was so lame. It was ridiculous. And
so the screen was just black.
The screen was black.
For 12 minutes.
For 12 minutes. And if you turned it on afterwards, you know, it made no sense to anybody who hasn't been following the story.
Yeah.
Consequently, the station told us that thousands of people were calling in to complain. Amazing here in Alabama, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Thousands. They said that. And the station, by the way, is owned by the Bass family, who own Harkin Energy,
right.
Big supporters and donors.
Harkin Energy that used to be owned in part by George W. Bush.
Correct.
Yeah.
Strange.
What a series of odd coincidences.
Yes.
Mary, thank you for the heads up, and thanks for letting us know. And once again, contact CBS. Tell them, A, dig deeper into this story. There's more that you haven't covered. And, B, get on your Alabama affiliates and tell them to replay the story, maybe even during the evening news or something. I mean,
they did replay it, I think, because so many thousands called in. They did replay it, but it was at the crucial time during the Academy Awards at 10:20 at night when nobody's right. watching right. local news, you know. Yeah. That's yeah. when they replayed it.
We're
really hoping people call their congressman. I mean, I think this is going to this could be a crucial point to bring the Bush administration down.
I think this is clear evidence of crimes coming right out of the White House. You know, Karl Rove in charge of this thing. And the thing that 60 Minutes didn't even talk about last night that I hope that they'll get into in future ones is the theft of that election by Bob Riley and his buddies overnight. You know, Don Siegelman went to bed that night as the sitting Democratic governor, and the election results were in, and they showed that he had won the election. And during the middle of the night, the Republican who was in charge of one of the voting precincts, with no observers, with no Democrats in the room, suddenly says, "Oh, hey, look it, we just found 13,000 extra votes. I guess Bob Riley won instead of Don Siegelman." And that's what Don Siegelman was raising a stink about, so they threw his butt in prison at the behest of Karl Rove. Let 60 Minutes know that you want to hear more about this. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day,
5 days a week.
How about the magic of saving some lives? We're going to go March 10th. We're heading off to Africa. Ellen Ratner and I, and a couple other folks, Rusty Humphreys, Joe Madison, a few others. My son, Justin, is going along with us. And we're going to go into Darfur, and we're going to be taking a couple of tons of food, these called Sacks of Hope, they're called. And we put up a link over at TomHartman.com today where you can link off this thing and give $50 as the donation to basically, you know, provide for the sustenance for a person or a family, a small group of people for a while. And Ellen, I understand, I was talking to Joe on the phone last week, and he said that our flight from Nairobi, Kenya, into the South Sudan, we're going to be in the back, in the cargo compartment, along with a couple of tons of food, the cargo compartment of a 30-year-old Soviet cargo plane with no windows, and our seatbelt is that we're going to be tied at waist and chest to a vertical pole against their a rib in the side of the airplane. Are you looking forward to this?
I've sort of done stuff like that with the military, so I'm kind of used to it.
I haven't done that, but I've been in some pretty grim circumstances, and
this is going to be grim.
So yeah.
I can't wait to get a picture of you in that circumstance.
It'll be interesting, and we will be doing our show live on March 14th, the satellite phone God's willing, from the Darfur region, via satellite phone, from Africa. You and I, we will be on the air on this program and a couple of others. This is a good thing. I think it's a real good thing.
Yeah, I talked to Senator Sanders the other day, and he was very excited that you're going and that I'm going.
Yeah,
he's dying to hear about the trip, and said he even wants to get in the air with us while we're over there.
Yeah, Bernie's a real adventurer. He's done a fair amount of, you know, checking out the world himself, and it's not just like, you know, Tom DeLay, let's go to the resort spots. But in any case, what's going on in Washington, D.C. right now?
The big news, of course, is that the White House is fighting this FISA thing morning, noon, and night. Today, Dana Perina said that if the Democratic leadership would let the Senate bill on the House floor, it would pass. She focused on immunity, saying without immunity for the telecom companies, there's no program. She was asked about today's Washington Post op-ed that said the White House was using scare tactics. She said the term scare tactics must poll well because the Democrats are using it a lot. And then,
maybe this is true.
Our very own Jay Tamboli asked her, and he's an attorney by trade, asked her after the briefing about whether the surveillance court why not just try and use some of the alternatives offered by the Senate, such as asking the FISA court to rule on whether the companies had acted in good faith. He said her eyes glazed over a bit, and she said the House should just take up the Senate bill.
So, in other words, they don't want the judiciary involved in this at all. You know, I have been corresponding for some time with, I'm not going to out this guy, so no details, but with an executive with one of the major networks, let's just leave it at that, who said that, in an email to me today, said that it is mind-boggling the number of news releases that they're getting out of the White House, many of them through back channels, many of them going to individuals, all of them saying the same thing, that this telecom immunity, this immunity has to be passed. I mean, there's just a, he said he's never in his entire career never seen anything like it. The White House is frantic. Frantic was the word he used, frantic about this.
Well, they're going to have to do some negotiation because Pelosi does not seem to want to just take up the Senate bill. She said she wants it to go to conference and she wants it discussed in conference.
Yep. And this is where now is a good time to call Nancy Pelosi's office and call your member of the House of Representatives and say, good on you for not going along with the Senate bill. You know, we're here with you. We've got your back. And you know, hold on tight and don't give in. You know, we should not say to companies that have broken the law knowingly. I mean, you had at least one company that said, no, I'm not going to break the law and refused to do it. You're not going to say to companies that have broken the law knowingly, along with an administration that broke the law knowingly, that we'll give you guys a pass. We're going to throw, you know, all these people who are smoking pot in jail, but you guys, you get to pass. No.
Well, particularly because there were telecom companies that did not take.
Yeah, yeah.
And where's their reward?
Right. Well, Quest, I think, was the one. That said no, and the reward is that their CEO is now in prison.
Yeah, well.
And
you
I
don't know if you saw the Siegelman thing on
I think it's the same thing. I think it's a politically motivated prosecution.
And Brad on his Brad blog, this morning showed that in fact they had technical problems for the first 15 minutes of it,
in Alabama. Yeah, we had a caller from Huntsville, Alabama, who said she watched her TV screen go black for 12 minutes.
Right.
And there was nothing there. And then,
I wonder who was behind that.
Yeah, well, she said that the TV station is owned by the Bass family, which owns Harkin Oil, which used to be George Bush's company, and they're big donors to his campaign. I'm passing along hearsay at this point, but this is what a caller from Alabama said. So who knows? I don't know. It's pretty mind-boggling. By the way, it is being reported that Mitt Romney's thinking of getting back into the race.
I saw that. I mean,
what do you think?
Give me a break. Well, you know, I write for the right-wing columnist WorldNet Daily, and today's column has to do with the 1860 convention and how Lincoln was able to pull it out, being really fourth choice almost.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he probably thinks that somehow if McCain doesn't wind up with every one of those delegates, that he can somehow come in and save the day.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. Do you think that he actually thinks that?
I think the guy's right out of his mind.
Yeah. Well, but he's got $400 million.
Point, when you have $500 million and you've been governor of a state, I think you're kind of delusional. People often who get money become pretty delusional about their ability and their power and why they're there. Often it's luck, but they don't see it that way. They see that they have somehow been granted some special power.
Right, sort of like George W. Bush saying that God ordained him for the job, and you know this is his mission from God was to invade Iraq.
Exactly.
Yeah. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. If you want information about the trip that Ellen and I are going on to Darfur on March 10th, you can get it over at tomhartmann.com. I'm assuming you'll have something at talkradionews.com, Ellen?
We're going to take your thing and do the same thing.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Thanks. Thanks, Ellen.
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy
with
Zone.
Tom Hartmann.
The Tom Hartmann Program.
Democracy Zone with Tom Hartmann.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. What is the current status of liberal and conservative politics in the United States? Of the liberal and conservative movements in the United States? Al Regnery is one of the real spectators and experts on this entire thing. Publisher of the American Spectator, author of Upstream, The Ascendance of American Conservatism, and former president and publisher of Regnery Publishing, which has produced 22 New York Times bestsellers during his tenure. Alfred Regnery. Al, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Nice to be with you.
And glad to have you. You have a new book out. It is called Upstream, The Ascendance of American Conservatism. Publisher of the American Spectator, it says right at the bottom. And a picture of Goldwater and Reagan on the cover. And I found this a fascinating book. Unlike, for example, Russell Kirk's book, which you referenced numerous times throughout the book, Kirk, you know, drilled deep into conservative philosophy. You cite Edmund Burke, for example, numerous times as well. You know, and Kirk's entire first chapter was on Edmund Burke. Goldwater was a big fan of. In fact, arguably Russell Kirk was the guy who got Goldwater to become who he was by the 60s. And speaking as someone who I call myself a liberal, and I have tremendous respect for Barry Goldwater. I campaigned for him in 1964. I was 13 years old.
Really?
And I've read Burke, and in particular Burke's debates with Thomas Paine, which I found particularly fascinating, and which led to Paine to write The Rights of Man, as I'm sure you know. And I've read Kirk, and I've read Goldwater, both of Goldwater's autobiographies. What I found about your book was that it was a great overview of kind of the history of the modern incarnations and reincarnations of the conservative movement. And what so baffles me about the modern conservative movement is how it could have gone from what you could arguably call principled conservatism, you know, sort of the Russell Kirk, even Edmund Burke form of what I would call an elite conservatism. You know, Burke was very distrustful of the rabble, of the masses, to Reagan, who had the largest number of administration officials convicted of corruption, who ran up the biggest budget deficits, who declared war on countries that were not a threat to us, who by any measure, who grew government faster than anybody in history and who ran up greater debt than anybody in history, was not a conservative. How does the conservative movement make that arc, and where are they going to end up now?
Well, I understand your question. I would differ with you on Reagan. I mean, Reagan's budget deficit was largely the Defense Department. And in terms of corruption, there was some, but it wasn't as much as many other administrations. But that's beside the point.
But I mean, Reagan grew all the agencies for example, he put Bill Bennett in charge of education because Bill Bennett said he wanted to destroy the agency, and then Bennett made the agency larger.
The size of it, right?
Right.
Yeah, it is a very good question, and it's always problematic, I guess, to try to explain it. Maybe there isn't really an explanation except for the fact that it's politics. And I guess whenever pure philosophical people get involved in politics, things change. And politics is such a matter of compromises and deals and trying to get things done on the one hand, and you give up something on the other hand. I mean, that's just the way the system works, that I suppose it is probably almost always corrupting, not in the normal sense of people being paid off, but just corrupting intellectually and morally.
Well, you talk in your book about how in the 60s everybody thought William F. Buckley Jr. was going to be the great, great hope, you know, and he was a good guy. He used to love firing line. I quoted him extensively in one of my books. I've talked with him and quoted him with permission. And, you know, another genuine principled conservative back in the day when there were such things, I think. And yet, as you point out in your book, you say, you know, the conservative icon got 13% of the vote in the most liberal city in the country.
Right.
Could it be that the only way that conservatives can win in America is by doing what George Herbert Walker Bush did against Michael Dukakis, which is basically sloganeering? You know, oh, the guy, you know, with the Willie Horton stuff and, he, you know, flag burning and stuff, things that really have nothing to do with conservatism. Or by, as Ronald Reagan did, actually being the worst kind of liberal.
Well, Reagan, though, ran on a very conservative platform. I mean, and you actually go back to Nixon, say, in both 68 and 72, ran on very conservative platforms, too.
But they didn't govern that way.
Conservatives. You know, he wasn't a conservative at all. But he figured out that Nixon did, particularly, that he needed to do that in order to get elected. I think Reagan was a very principled conservative. I mean, as you read my chapter on Reagan, you go back and you look at what he was saying, even when he was a Democrat and when he called himself a liberal, it was pretty consistent with what he did. And basically he had, you know, a certain number of things that were very important to him. Number one was restoring a sound
economy and restoring the sort of the principles of free markets. And, yeah, as a president, there's only so much you can do. The other was, of course, winning the Cold War. And we at least attribute a great deal of that to him. The third thing that he wanted to do was sort of restore people's faith in the presidency and in government generally, of course, having come out of the Carter administration when things were really in horrible shape economically and were
but he was saying the opposite.
Malaise and that sort of thing. You know, and he did that not in order to make people think that government could do things for them, but basically to restore the whole system so that it worked more or less. And when he left office, he had accomplished those things. I mean, there were an awful lot of things that he didn't do because I think, and I served in his administration, that I remember sitting in meetings with him in the White House, and you talk about something other than his sort of three or four principles, and it didn't register. I mean, because those were things I think that he figured you just couldn't do. There were so many things that you could do as president, and so much time, and if you tried to do more things than that, you weren't going to get anything accomplished.
Yeah. Al, we could debate conservative good or bad, but I really didn't want this. And in fact, I would disagree with some of your characterizations of Reagan, including in your book. I mean, you know, Reagan's famous.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help."
It's kind of inconsistent with the notion that he was there to restore faith in government, you know, for example. But I'm really curious about your take on some of these things, actually, because I think that this book is just a good, clean, honest evaluation of where the conservative movement's at to a large extent. And you talk about, for example, later on in the book, page 336, upstream, you know, if conservatism lacked a consensus on the religious question, the input of political philosophers helped to keep the conversation in a fruitful direction. Then you get into Kirk and the sense of despondency and the coalitions of anti-collectivism was basic. But, you know, when you look at it in that context, it's almost like conservatism has always been a reactionary force rather than a proactive force in the United States. It's always been against collectivism, against the Soviet Union, against communism, against atheism, as it were. How does the conservative movement move forward? Even today, Bill Kristol, you know, in the New York Times, taking gratuitous pot shots at Barack Obama, they're all against. Where is the positive agenda in the conservative movement? I mean, even with abortion, it's, you know, against abortion. Where is the positive movement?
It probably is largely outside of politics. I mean, in universities, for example, there's a great debate that goes on conservative principles, or in the think tanks and writings and magazines and all those sorts of things.
But by and large, aren't those mostly libertarian debates these days?
No, I don't think so. Many of them are more than that. I mean, there's the debate on the Constitution, for example, I think is probably a very good positive debate. Obviously, conservatives take one position, liberals take a different position. But for the most part, I mean, if you go to a Federalist Society debate, for example, in law school, you'll find a really good, pure discussion about how do you interpret the Constitution, or how do you interpret the Commerce Clause, or whatever it is.
But if you look at the records of Scalia and Rehnquist and Alito and Roberts, a little newer, but just Scalia, for example, you find that these so-called originalist, conservative, strict constructionist judges have overturned more laws than happened during the Warren Court, which was a very liberal court. So arguably they're far more activist.
That may be because of what laws they were and the way they were enacted and the way that they applied to the Constitution. I mean, it's, and what Scalia's point is and what conservatives want in judges is not result-oriented people who are going to overturn a law they don't like. It's judges who will look at the Constitution, look at the law, apply it honestly and say, "I can't stand what this law does, but nevertheless, I'm still going to let it stand." You know, that's the pure position. And and there are some judges that do that, certainly. There's some that probably don't. But, again, courts are somewhat political as well.
Right.
I guess, you know.
Well, it's a fascinating look at the conservative movement, and I recommend it to my listeners. Upstream is the book, The Ascendance of American Conservatism. Al Regnery is the author. Al, thanks for dropping by today.
Thanks very much. Nice to be with you.
And is there a website for it, by the way, for
there
the
book? There is, upstream2008.com.
Okay, great.
Available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all those places.
Yeah, fine bookstores near you. Indeed.
Great.
Al, thanks a lot
for
being
with us. Nice to be with
16
you.
Minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Very troubling article. Welcome back, by the way, 21 minutes past the hour. Very troubling article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal today. U.S., the headline, article by Glenn R. Simpson. Headline, U.S. weighs sanctions on Iran's central bank. Now, buried down in the article, it points out the central bank is the keystone of Iran's financial system and its principal lifeline to the international banking system. So here is the, you know, the main artery, all the blood flowing through here. Here's the main artery in the Iranian banking system. And what is the Bush administration doing but going after it? The Treasury Department is gathering evidence it says shows that the Central Bank of Iran is helping other Iranian institutions elude U.S. economic sanctions in what could be a prelude to penalties against the bank. The Wall Street Journal refers to this as an escalation in the financial battle Washington is waging against Tehran. Not good news. Maybe this is, you know, part of why gold seems to be spiking. Jessalyn McCurdy is with us, speaking here as a card-carrying member of the ACLU. I'm very pleased to have the legislative counsel for the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, Jessalyn McCurdy, on the line with us. Jessalyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
ACLU.org, of course, the website if you want more information or if you want to sign up. You folks are fighting a long time injustice, and I think this is absolutely great that you have taken this on. This, the disparity in federal mandatory sentences for crack versus powder cocaine, this is racism on, I was going to say on steroids. I'm tempted to make a bad whatever and say it's racism on. Yeah, well, it's a kind of racism on crack, you know. It's,
yeah, right, it's, right. I guess some would say.
So tell me what's going on with this.
Sure. Over 20 years ago, back in 1986, right after the death of Lynn Bias, a former University of Maryland basketball star who was drafted by the Boston Celtics and died 3 days after the NBA draft, what people thought was a crack cocaine overdose. Shortly after Lynn Bias' death, Congress kicked into action and passed this law, which is now known as the 100-to-1 disparity between crack and powder cocaine. And basically what that means is 5 grams of crack cocaine will get you a mandatory 5-year sentence, whereas 500 grams of powder cocaine gets a person the same sentence for selling
and
powder cocaine.
Right, and the fact of the matter is that if you walk around Wall Street and you're hanging out with guys who are making a million, 5 million, 10 million bucks a year, and they're snorting cocaine, it's always going to be powder.
It is, for the most part.
And if you walk into poor African American communities and you're talking to folks who are selling cocaine or using cocaine, more often than not, it's crack. Is that not an accurate portrayal of the difference?
That is a pretty accurate portrayal. And what we also know is that 80% of the people who are convicted of crack cocaine offenses are African Americans.
Right. And the fact of the matter is, there's probably, I believe this to be true, tell me if I'm right or wrong, there are more whites in the United States who are using cocaine and abusing cocaine than there are African-Americans in the United States who are using and abusing any form of cocaine.
That is true. What we know, I think the important thing to kind of look at in the context of that over 80% of African-Americans who are being convicted on the federal level of crack cocaine offenses is that we know that 66% of the crack cocaine users are white or Hispanic.
And I think
that speaks volumes to the fact that law enforcement are targeting certain communities where African Americans lived, because there's an incentive built into this law by having the trigger for crack cocaine so low at 5 grams, it's so easy to make a crack cocaine case versus 500 grams of powder cocaine.
Right. So it seems to me, I mean, all of this is the terrible stepchild of the Rockefeller drug laws. I mean,
mm-hmm.
when we started this whole war on drugs, it really was a war on poverty. People, in particular, I would say. People living in communities where there is no economic opportunity, they become entrepreneurs, and this is one of the few entrepreneurial opportunities available
to them.
Absolutely. And we all applaud the entrepreneurial spirit, and then we put these people in jail. I mean, it's totally bizarre. So what do we do?
Right, and obviously it's wrong. No one is saying it's not wrong to sell drugs, but I think, you know, one of the things that that came out of the 80s is that this oftentimes was the only opportunity for people in urban communities where there weren't any jobs or you didn't have an education to be able to support their family. And I'm not trying to make an excuse for them, you know, it's against the law, it's wrong. But what I think we need to recognize is to be able to, and we need to recognize to give people employment opportunities to be able to support their families so that they don't have to turn to selling crack cocaine to do that. We also need to deal with getting people treatment who are addicted to crack cocaine and powder cocaine, whatever drug, quite frankly, to be able to deal with their addiction versus trying to throw them in jail and prison and thinking that's going to deal with their addiction.
Right. We haven't created a war on drugs. We've created a war on people.
Absolutely.
So we just have 10 seconds left. I'm sorry, the ACLU is doing what?
We are lobbying Congress to change this law. There was a hearing last week, 2 weeks ago in the Senate, and there's going to be a hearing tomorrow. And we are asking people to contact their members of Congress to reform this crack cocaine law.
Great. And you can read all about it at ACLU.org. And if you want to call Congress, callcongress.org has all the phone numbers, toll-free numbers and whatnot to call Congress. And join with the ACLU in saying, let's reform this horrible crack cocaine legislation. Thanks so much, Jesslyn, for being
with us. Thank you for having me.
Jesslyn McCurdy, 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-302-2270. Back 34 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans, because keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Bob in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today? Bob?
Hello?
You're on the air.
Hello, Tom?
Yes, sir. Yes, Bob, you are on the air, if you can hear me.
Hello?
Apparently, Bob can't hear me. Let's see if Jim in...
Hello, Tom.
Yes, Bob.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can, just fine.
No, I can't hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry, Bob. I'm gonna put you on... Jim in Berkeley. Hey, Jim, can you hear me now?
Can you hear me?
At a bad cell phone commercial?
Exactly, yeah. Well, and that's for Verizon. We don't need to talk about them and their wiretapping right now. The NSA can hear us now, I'm sure.
Yeah, and they've been listening to us since before 9/11,
an important
point that is often lost in this, in fact, is almost always lost in the media discussions of this topic.
Absolutely. Hey, I wanted to just ask you, I have no particular opinion upon this. I'm leaning towards Obama in the election, but you know, I read the blogs, and every now and then the Tony Rezko issue comes up.
Right.
I know that Clinton raised it once in a debate. It doesn't seem to have had a lot of legs so far, and the Clinton campaign doesn't seem to have been harping on it that much. What's your opinion on it? Is this a story that's going anywhere? Should it go somewhere? Just in the, you know, you were talking about vetting the candidates in the first hour, and I'd like this to be dealt with now instead of by the Republicans if there's any substance to it, but I don't know if there is.
You know, there was a good article about it. I forget whether it was in The Nation or The New Republic, or it was in one of the, or maybe even Atlantic. There was a very good article about the whole background of the thing.
And of course, there's a series of articles in the Sun-Times and so on.
A month
Wikipedia
or so,
has an entry on Tony Rezko with some references, but that's as far as I've been able to get with it.
You know, if my recollection is correct, Jim, and it may well not be on this because I don't put myself out as an authority on the Obama campaign or on Tony Rezko or any of this stuff. I mean, I've been kind of watching it. Not trying to play opposition research for either campaign. But my recollection is that the arguably the strongest charge that was made against him was that he helped Barack Obama buy his home. and that there was some sort of preferential treatment there. And apparently that's been debunked, that, that it was offered, that, that Obama was actually the highest bidder on that house. And so that may be why the story has no legs, if that's the piece of it. And if not, I'm sure somebody will correct me. And also, you know, in terms of if we're going to go through all the people who have donated money to political campaigns and what their past is, I mean, it's like, you know, this, you know, Bill Ayers given $200 to the Obama campaign. Bill Ayers was, you know, a weatherman who with Bernadette, what's her name, his wife had actually, you know, set off some bombs back in the 60s and killed some people. And my SDS chapter at MSU had him and his wife come as a keynote speaker a couple of months ago. And there was just this screaming debate going on in email among a bunch of us about whether or not this was appropriate. You know, to, you know, he's still a controversial figure, even in SDS. And but, you know, hey, you know, he's an individual and he gave $200. What's the big deal? I mean, it's like if you went through all the people who gave money to the Bush campaign or to the McCain campaign or to the Clinton campaign, you're going to find a few folks that you could disagree with or that you could smear with. And so I, you know, frankly, my take on it, Jim, is that it's a story that doesn't have legs. If it did, the Clinton campaign would have used them by now.
And that
would be a good, and thank you for the call on it. And that, as I said before, would in fact be a good thing. Just like John McCain having these charges against McCain coming out now, that's actually a good thing for McCain. It's better to have this stuff come out early in a campaign and get aired and vetted and get the stories knocked down and get have the candidates have an opportunity to respond to them than later. It's why it's a good thing that Hillary Clinton is staying in the race. It's a good, at least through Texas and Ohio, and then, you know, she can make up her mind. But right now, hey, there's a chance she could still win the election. She should absolutely stay in the race. And what it does is it makes Barack Obama a better candidate. Or if Hillary Clinton's the nominee, it makes her a better candidate. Both of them are becoming better candidates as a consequence of this competition. And I, you know, I just I'm all in favor of it. I think it's a marvelous thing. Ed in Hillsboro, Oregon. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Good show as always.
Thank you.
The reason I called is that with Nader in the news today, it kind of gives us a chance to take a step back from the tactics and infighting and take a kind of a bigger strategic look for a moment and think back on 2000 a little bit and what happened there. And I had three observations that I wanted to make real quick. One of them is that if Gore had wanted Nader's voters to vote for him, then he would have pitched his campaign to appeal to him. But instead, he followed the DLC playbook of ignoring the progressive side of the spectrum and pitching to the right, even, you know, with things like the alien Gonzalez issue, trying to outright wing Bush on Gonzalez.
Right.
And as a result of that, he really, you know, lost the Nader vote, the far progressive vote, by ignoring them. And,
you know, yeah, in 2000, well, again, I always have to put in this caveat. Louise and I lived in Vermont at the time, and we knew Vermont was going to go for Gore. And so, you know, and I voted for Ralph Nader in the 2000 election, and I'm still, frankly, proud of that vote. I thought it was a good thing. I wanted the Green Party to get there. I think it was 5%. It might be 15%, whatever that threshold was that they had to get in order to get federal matching funds for the next campaign. I think having an alive and active and vibrant Green Party is a good thing. And I like what Ralph Nader was saying. Louise, on the other hand, voted for Al Gore. Between the two of us, you know, we were offering a vote for each. We did that very intentionally. Had I lived in Florida or Ohio or Michigan, or, you know, where I grew up, I wouldn't have done that. I would have voted for Al Gore.
Yeah, I was in a similar boat. I was in a non-contested state. The other two observations real quick is that the DLC strategy of tilting to the right to try and win that 50% plus one out of the center, Florida 2000 showed exactly what the problem with that strategy is, which is that if you just win by 50% plus one, then the other side can steal it, you know, and that's exactly
that's right.
What happened. It wasn't a wide enough margin for Gore to, you know, he did win it, but he didn't win it by enough to where it couldn't be, you know, taken back from him from the election fraud and the judicial coup.
Harry, yeah, you're absolutely right, Ed. Thanks for pointing it out. Harry Truman was the guy who really brought this into high relief. Harry Truman, the Democratic president of the United States, when asked about, you know, campaigning and how a person should strategically campaign, suggested that Democrats should run as Democrats, Republicans should run as Republicans. And in fact, the famous part of his quote is he said, when the voters are given a choice between a Democrat who acts like a Republican or a real Republican, they'll pick the real Republican every time. And of course, you could flip it around. When they're given a choice between a Republican who acts like a Democrat or a real Democrat, they'll vote for the real Democrat every time. And that seems to have been lost by the Democratic Party to some extent, although the Republican Party got it for a while there. Sean in Detroit. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing today?
Just great. What's up?
Okay, in regards to the Bush and his warrantless wiretapping,
mm-hmm.
I'm actually currently in the market for some new wireless service.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I keep seeing from everything I've searched on the Internet, AT&T, Verizon, Bell South, I don't know whether that's pertaining to landlines or wireless, seem to be coming up all the time. But I really want to make sure I don't give my money to a company that's breaking the law.
Yeah.
So,
as far as I know, Qwest was the one company that said no thank you to George Bush's wiretap rules. And I'm not sure if they're a wireless provider. The other one that I don't know about, which is who, a lot of people are using for wireless service because they don't require contracts, is Virgin. Whether Virgin went along with the administration or not, I don't know. And I've been keeping an eye out. I've never seen their name mentioned one way or the other, frankly.
Is there a source out there that we can resource, or is it somewhat that it's maybe unclear that whether or not some companies did a...
Yeah, Sean, I don't know. I mean, other than the lawsuits that have been filed that have named some of the large providers, the ACLU lawsuit, beyond that, I don't know. And as far as I know, Virgin wasn't named in that, and Qwest wasn't named in that, and Virgin is a national cell provider. But you might want to contact the company, and or you might want to go over to TomHartmann.com and on our message board just start a thread asking if anybody knows, or drop into our live chat room. It's amazing the resources, the intellectual resources of the people who listen to this program, and they'll get behind and they'll answer these kinds of questions, which is a marvelous thing. Janice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Janice.
Hi. I have called my representatives about the visa bill.
Good.
And I just wanted to say that I have decided I will not support Barack Obama in a general election, because just like that fellow who called earlier and said Hillary Clinton didn't show up for the visa bill, which really her vote would not have made or broken that, she was one of only 22 senators, Barack Obama was not one of them, who voted no for John Roberts. And so it really upsets me, because she's getting a bad deal in the press, in the media, and nobody is addressing this. And as a woman, I'm really, really upset. And I can't, this guy's only been around for a couple of years in the federal Senate, and we can only really go by his votes. And his votes do not represent the person he says he is. So I've had it, and I wish when people would call. The other thing is, he didn't even show up for the Iranian vote. But, he can criticize her and introduce a bill to limit it. So people need to do their research before they go criticizing her. That's all I have to say.
Janice, I agree with you. Let me pose a question to you, though, if I may. And I say this not as an Obama or a Clinton partisan, because I say this every day, and I will continue to say it until one or the other of them drops out of the race, that I think that both of them would make great presidents. Dennis Kucinich used to be very, very anti-abortion. He relatively recently changed his position. John Edwards voted in ways that were inconsistent with many of his current positions. Isn't it okay for a politician to change their mind?
Absolutely, but she's not being treated fairly in the media,
okay.
And that's what's upsetting.
Okay, yeah, okay. Got it. Janice, thanks a lot. I appreciate
it.
Good to hear
from
you. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartmann Program, the true people's radio.
Tom Hartmann.
Wake up, shaking up America. Our government is a fight for we the people, and can't ignore that we shall reap what we sow, so we better sow.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Imagine you're a Fox News host. You have on a comedian. You think he's just a normal, average comedian, and he's just going to make jokes. And instead, he says...
All right, Julia and Lee, we appreciate it. I'm sure you guys are going to have a lot more jokes for the rest of the campaign here. They just keep coming.
What? Can I just ask a question?
Sure.
What is Fox News? It's just a parade of propaganda, isn't it? It's just a festival of ignorance. What? Why, a million
Fox
people
News?
Are dead in Iraq. Come on, this is ridiculous. What's the point of this?
At which point the Fox hosts start to freak out.
This is insane.
Well, I love,
go
I
out,
love
people
Fox
at home,
News.
Go outside. Go hug
Lee,
your children.
Lee, you should be more,
well, Fox
you should
News
be more worried.
Love your family, you know.
And
you get all the news at Fox News. All the news you can at Fox News. All right, thanks,
and
guys.
I think,
and then Fox, of course, goes to some real news.
All right, that's it. All right. We're also talking about Captain Kirk this morning. And, hey, because it's Saturday morning, we're having some fun. Greg, you've got the cushiest job in the world.
Yeah, look who just beamed aboard right now. The ladies from the Starship Enterprise. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
How are you?
Okay.
In miniskirts.
Their friend Bones, you know him as Dr. McCoy, just wrote a new book on Captain Kirk and the way he's...
So Fox goes to real news. Girls from wearing miniskirts from outer space. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lee Camp was that comedian who was saying to the folks at Fox News, hey, you guys, there's a million people dead in Iraq. Why don't you know? It totally freaked them out. And he's on the line with us. Hey, Lee.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I am great. And I just want to say congratulations. You've done a good job. And there you go. Applause. So what provoked you to actually confront the droids at Fox News with reality?
I think the past 8 or 10 years of Fox News provoked me to do it. there was nothing in the segment that provoked me. They called me and asked me to be on, and at first I thought I was going to say no, but then I thought, you know what? What better place to tell them what a ridiculous and harmful channel they are? And so I had kind of planned to speak my mind, and that's what I did.
Interesting. I've done the Fox morning show, I don't know, half a dozen times or so, usually debating somebody like Mike Gallagher, you know, some conservative talk show has done an issue. Mm-hmm. And then I think one of the last times they called was to be on the Hannity show, and I just said, no, not going to do it. You know, it's enough already. I mean,
yeah.
there comes a point where you say, any kind of blowback, any kind of feedback?
Well, most of it's been overwhelming support. I mean, I think most people are really sick of the propaganda and the drivel that they spout. But you know, of course, there's plenty of hate mail as well. But it's pretty easy to take when you weigh it with all the support and the congrats and the, you know, I've wanted to say that for years. Thank you for doing it.
When we speak out here, we get stuff like this, Bill O'Reilly.
So. All those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yeah. So no threats like that, huh?
Well, there are definitely some comments that say, why isn't he in Guantanamo Bay, which is lovely. I think they don't understand exactly how freedom of speech works. But
there you go. Well, Lee, I wanted to get you on to just give you a kudos and say hi and play that. It's a great and funny bit, and thanks for dropping by. Is there a website you want to plug here while you're here?
Go ahead.
Is there a website you want to mention?
Oh, yes, leecamp.net. And, I do a lot of stand-up comedy, and my stuff's unapologetically opinionated because I feel like it's a crime not to talk about this stuff when I see where the country's headed. So leecamp.net, come and see me. It'd be great.
Great. Okay. Lee, thanks a lot for dropping by.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Margaret in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Margaret, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hello, Tom. I've never called before. But I listened to you today about the BSE.
The mad cow disease, yeah.
Exactly. And I wanted to tell you that I have a friend who has a farm here near Portland, and he has cows that he wanted to sell to Japan because of the last scare with the mad cow disease up in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked Japan if they would buy his cows. They would, but they had to be tested. So he went to a vet, and he got the vet to arrange to test all of his cows, $26 a piece. The government told him he could not do that. He could only test 3 cows.
Yeah, I read about that in the paper.
$50 each. And the other thing, I just wondered if you... Well, so you knew about that.
Yeah, and this is what the beef industry gets when they drop $41 million in lobbying.
Honestly...
I mean, we have, you know, it's the old joke about the best government money can buy. It's certainly true of Republican administrations. I mean, it's just that's the bottom line. Margaret, thanks a lot for raising the issue and for the call. I appreciate it. Tom in Portland. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Tom. I've been listening to your program for years. I love you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment about the Ralph Nader dialogue I heard earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to say that he's saying some very, very important things. He's not a one-issue person.
Yep.
And I heard some people call in referring to him as a crackpot or his followers as crackpots and this and that. But the fact of the matter is he's been a tireless campaigner for the people and for our democracy. And, you know, when we watch PBS NewsHour and we see these ads for Archer Daniels Midland and GE and all this kind of stuff, you know, when Archer Daniels Midland is buying up the farmland in the Midwest and doing monoculture and all this kind of stuff, and we're being duped into loving corporations and stuff, and then our
Nader's the guy. No, I got it, Tom. Nader's the guy who's raising the issues, and that's why I said I don't think that he's going to pull votes away from the Democratic Party, frankly, and I think it's a good thing that he's in here because he's going to be sane, just like I thought it was a good thing that Dennis Kucinich was in the primaries, even though there wasn't a chance that he was going to become the nominee, because he was saying the things that need to be said. Coming up tomorrow, Mark Morano with the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, talking about the General Motors executive who says global warming is a total crock of, you know. Plus, Dr. Mike Adams on his book, Feminists Say the Darndest Things. Oh, that should be entertaining. Plus, your calls and the best of the rest of the news right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy and activism begin with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.